Welcome to Rooster Radio. I'm Andrew Montesi, and today I talk urban design with David Cook, who is a registered architect, accredited planner, as well as an internationally qualified urban designer. David is the director of City Collective, a design studio that works across Australia and the world. He was the first South Australian to be awarded a prestigious scholarship at the University of California, Berkeley, in their intensive Masters of Urban Design program. David is now using this knowledge and global experience to address the urban renewal challenges that face Australian cities. David shares his deep insights into the impact of major sporting events. Winning an Olympic and Commonwealth Games bid can make or break a city, depending on the organiser's approach to urban planning. We talk about smart cities, an aspirational phrase talked about by many governments and planners, but not widely understood. David reveals what we can learn from the high-tech cities that have been reborn out of the US Rust Belt, and the steps that can be taken to address current critical issues in Australia, such as housing affordability. A successful urban designer specialises in long-term thinking. We're talking decades ahead of present day. David talks about his planning approach and much more. Enjoy our chat. David, welcome to Rooster Radio.
Thank you for the opportunity.
First question, when you see the images from Rio post-Olympics, the infrastructure that's falling apart, buildings abandoned, as an urban designer, what goes through your mind?
Oh, look, it certainly is a lost opportunity, without a doubt. I don't think anybody really wants to see those types of images, particularly after the images that we saw of a very successful Games. But it certainly is that missed opportunity to really use sporting infrastructure like that as a way to really regenerate parts of that city.
So what is the root cause of the issue when this happens, when the infrastructure falls apart? Clearly the planning was in place. As an urban designer, what are the core fundamentals that you look at and say, okay, clearly something's gone wrong here?
Look, I'm not totally sure what the overall planning was in terms of that particular Games, but some of the fundamentals would have to be just not actually planning for that medium to long term outcome. One of the major challenges with a Games like Rio has just experienced is you get very focused on delivering the Games. And that's pretty important. You've got the eyes of the world focused on you. You've got the world descending upon you. You have to make sure that the 100-metre track is 100 metres. And it's very easy for governments and for leaders and organising committees to just focus on that. Legacy, and that word gets used quite a lot in mega sporting events, is certainly a very big component into securing a sporting event like that, and I'm sure Rio had lots of legacy plans. One of the biggest issues, and we've seen this with many Games around the world, is that legacy becomes becomes something that is not carried through. So once the event has happened, that now becomes yesterday's story. Why are we still, governments often ask the question, why are we still spending millions of dollars in this event? Isn't that over? We've received the closing ceremony. Everybody's given us a pat on the back. Why are we still spending millions of dollars? That funding gets pulled. What that means is then the legacy outcomes that were hoped and intended also get pulled with that. So I would only imagine that that was one of the major issues with what's happened in Rio.
So what should it mean for a city winning a Games? What should it mean beyond the couple of weeks or month that a Games actually occurs?
If you actually plan for it, and this is some of the work that I've done, if you actually plan for it and think of it in the medium to long term, don't focus on the 2 weeks or the 10 days. That's hard to do for sure, but focus on what is going to be a 20-year and a 30-year lifestyle, a 30-year legacy, and to achieve those lifestyle aspects for a city. They really just become, events like this really just become the opportunity for urban regeneration and a catalyst for urban regeneration, for social regeneration, and then also for economic activity as well in that longer term.
And what does that look like from a practical perspective in terms of using that infrastructure from the event? Like, what are the kind of issues or aspects that can live on?
It's very important to actually focus on the infrastructure and plan for it early, that if it's of a particular scale to meet the event itself, for it to actually have a secondary use, a legacy use, planned for it at the very start. We've only just seen this as a problem in London out of their 2012 games, that they didn't really plan for what their main stadium was going to be used for. There was, at the time, the legacy was very much focused around that's going to be a premier stadium for athletics. That soon became realistic that was not going to happen because there isn't a demand for an athletics stadium of that size within the United Kingdom. And then it was going to be leased to some football clubs. The overall design of the stadium was not accommodating for a soccer stadium. The whole stadium bounced around and oscillated, and in the end it has now been repurposed as a football stadium. What that has done is that has actually turned that stadium per seat as the most expensive stadium within Europe. Now, that didn't need to happen, but that is just a perfect example of not pre-planning, of not actually saying, okay, we're going to use that as the main stadium, but we know in 5 years' time it will be used as a soccer stadium, so let's design that before the event happens. So that becomes very important, and maybe that's one of the opportunities that has been lost within Rio, is they didn't really plan for that. They didn't really consider how those stadiums can be used and how that infrastructure in particular can be used after the event.
So you mentioned that you've been doing this type of work. I mean, can you share some of the work that you've done in this space?
Yeah, so we actually have spent quite a considerable amount of time focusing on Adelaide and how Adelaide can play to its strengths and use a mega sporting event like the Commonwealth Games as a way to start to solve some of its own urban, social and economic challenges, and really as a way to start to use that particular event as a way to create a greater identity for Adelaide. Adelaide is 1.2 million people in population size. There are 256 cities in the world that are around 1 to 1.2 million people. So quite often out of Adelaide, we often compare ourselves rightly or wrongly to Melbourne or Sydney or to Brisbane, always peering over the neighbour's fence. But I would challenge that perhaps we need to stop that and we need to focus on our international agenda and actually compare ourselves to those other cities of a population size. That's where a mega sporting event like the Commonwealth Games has that opportunity to showcase ourselves to the world and showcase the beautiful city that we have and the natural assets that we have, and hopefully start to secure population growth and also start to secure some of that economic growth, which we are competing with against those other international cities.
So you brought in a proposal wouldn't be doing it justice, but a massive thick booklet which goes through some of your plans for Adelaide and how it might look. Can you maybe talk through some of the key features that you've included in this plan?
Yeah, the overall key features is very much focused on not using that. I propose to use Adelaide 2030 as a Commonwealth Games. There's opportunities for Adelaide to have a Commonwealth Games in 2026. Or in 2030, the overall thinking and analysis that we've undertaken could work for both. It doesn't really matter if it's 26 or 2030, but we started the overall thinking to focus on what are the challenges that Adelaide is confronted with now, and that they are challenges that many cities throughout the world are confronted with in terms of an aging population, low population growth, urban sprawl, automobile dependency, competing for economic attraction, as we were just talking about. So they're Adelaide's challenges. And then we started to focus on how can Adelaide play to its strengths. Adelaide has always had a really good history of hosting events, from F1 Grand Prix to now the Tour Down Under, which receives international accolades, to Masters Games and multi-sports events, even just to weekly football. We've got a good history. So let's play to our strengths. Let's try not be something else. Let's work to our strengths. So that then focused the overall thinking around what type of event could be used as that way, as a catalyst to address some of Adelaide's challenges and to play to our strengths. And it really came about that the Commonwealth Games, as a mega sporting event and a multi-sport event, has that opportunity to address many aspects across metropolitan Adelaide and the city centre, and to really focus on those, challenges. And then we simply started to demonstrate, what is the outcome? What is the legacy first? How are we going to address those challenges and then work our way back from that position to then implement a strategy, starting off in the first stage with some very modest incisions within the urban fabric around the City of Adelaide, a tram loop that actually repairs light squares, focusing on lights plan and how that can be repaired, some small infill housing opportunities and starting to focus on some urban repair, activating the parklands, but just allowing people to engage with them and for a reason for that, and changing some of the mobility within the overall city. Then moving in the stage two, which then becomes the event phase, we analyse that many of the sporting infrastructure that Adelaide has, that is apparently games ready, by the time 2026 or 2030 would come around, most of that infrastructure is going to be 45 years old. Even the Oval, which we all love, would be 15 years old. So it would certainly not be up to standard and would certainly not be up to sporting code standards. So then that then creates us with an opportunity to say, well, is the position of much of that sporting infrastructure in the right position? Are we getting the right urban, social and economic benefits out of that position? So that then challenged our thinking in terms of, for one in particular, being the cycling centre out of Jepps Cross. Maybe that's not in the right position and maybe that is now reaching the end of its natural life, particularly in 2026, 2030 context. So we then proposed the idea of moving that and activating that within Victoria Park, being quite mindful of the significant position of that and putting it half underground as a overall design concept, creating a reduced footprint in terms of BMX facilities, springboarding off the roof of this new National Cycling Centre. But what that ultimately does, more importantly, it actually creates a National Cycling Centre for Adelaide. We've got the premier event in terms of cycling within South Australia. But
we're known for it, aren't we?
Exactly. But here's an opportunity for us to actually create a home for cycling, not only within Australia, but then also potentially throughout our Asian region as well. And then in the third stage of the report, it shows how we can actually deliver many of the government's targets, particularly in terms of population and vibrancy within the city. We focused on a underdeveloped area in the city centre as the athletes precinct, being the southwest corner of the City of Adelaide. We analysed much of the land ownership within there, and we saw that there's a great opportunity to put in 17,500 residents within that area, which is only 10% of the land area of the City of Adelaide. And we're able to, so that's 50% of the state government and the city council's population targets in 10% of the land area of Adelaide. And we're able to do that by using predominantly 4 to 5 to 6 story buildings. There are only a handful of buildings over 10 stories. And the overall reason for that is not because we're against height or anything like that. We just had a very simple design rule to say access to ground level units, access to natural light for ground level units, which then capped out the height at around that size. More importantly, and we often get quite a lot of inquiry about this, is we then undertook a series of economic analysis in terms of this proposition. And what we determined is that for every $1 spent, there was a 2.26 economic return and 41,000 full-time equivalent jobs created. Once again, this isn't actually to host the Commonwealth Games. This is just getting us ready as a city to host the Commonwealth Games. We've actually seen even over in New York how they actually used their failed Olympic bid, I think it was for 2012, as a catalyst for the regeneration of their Hudson Yards precinct. So it's very, I was quite pleased to learn about this because I think it could then start to demonstrate confidence in Adelaide to say, we don't necessarily need to be successful. We can even fail and still be successful.
So it creates a shift in thinking, irrespective of whether you win the bid or not, but all of a sudden you're actually thinking, okay, well, what do we want to be? What do we want this place to look like?
Yes, yeah. And more importantly, it actually starts to bring the private sector and the public sector together on a common aim. It actually allows all tiers of the public sector and the private sector to have that common target. You know, even just simply putting up 2026, 2030 as that target, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're aiming for. Budgets can be allocated towards that. Private sector can respond to some of the public works that may happen or potentially may happen. Investment decisions can be focused. And then that starts to achieve an outcome in itself. And that would be a successful outcome, even if the bid for the games was not. Mm.
And how do you think so far ahead? I mean, I know this would sound very much like a layman's type of question, but when you're talking about 2030 and when you're even thinking beyond that period, what are the fundamentals or how do you actually go about thinking?
It's always that's an interesting question. It's always very important to think of the issues, to think of the issues that we can confront now. Much of the work that City Collective is focused in at the moment is very much around solving issues. Mm-hmm. We often say to some of our clients, if you don't have issues, we can't really solve them. We can't really solve for you. But we're very much focused around solving issues. And then we do quite a lot of historic benchmarking because one of the things that we've really learned and is many of the issues that Adelaide, for instance, or Australian cities, for instance, are facing are certainly not new. Mm. There's other similar issues and challenges throughout the world. So there's a real opportunity for us to explore what other cities around the world are focusing on. And then that starts to define our approach and our methodology. And then ultimately we just have to be big thinkers, really, and just be quite bold and put forward our visions based upon that analysis and benchmarking, and that seems to define some pretty exciting outcomes.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been talking about cities, but smart cities is a phrase that a lot of people would hear. Yeah. What does a smart city actually look like?
It's a very good question. I don't think anybody really knows the answer to that particular question yet. What we've seen is we've seen Smart Cities 1.0. And Smart Cities 1.0 has been very much driven by the technology companies. So very much driven by the whole driverless car debate, making people's and a city user's life easier to operate within the city. So Google Maps and everything that Google offers, and making commerce and transactions easier within the city. But it's all been very much focused from the technology companies creating technology and then trying to sell that technology to cities. We're starting to now see a change in that, and we're seeing a change into what's been called Smart Cities 2.0. And that's very much focused around what is the city's outcome from that? What is the urban and what is the built environment outcome for that? And that's an area that's in flux at the moment. And we're really trying to grapple and understand how that influx of technology that we're experiencing as a society and as cities throughout the world, how that is going to impact on our urban environment. What is our experience when we step out of our office building at 10:30 for our morning coffee and we walk down the street and we pick up our coffee and we might run into somebody that we know? What is that experience like on a Tuesday morning in a smart city? Yeah. That's the question we're trying to answer at the moment. Is it a completely different experience? Is the do we even walk? Is there even a footpath? You know, these are the challenges that we that we don't actually know yet.
From small details through to big details.
Correct. Yep. Correct. And the other part of smart city is smart city 3.0, which we're trying to aspire to, and that's very much driven not around the technology, not around the city fabric, but around the people. It's how the people's experience and the citizens' experience within a city is then driving the smart city agenda. In the end, smart cities and the whole terminology of smart cities is really just an accelerator to what is really a very broad definition of a sustainable city.
Yeah. So when you think about smart cities or a sustainable city, who's doing it well? I mean, you've been well-travelled, particularly lately, been around the world, seen many a city. What's really stood out to you?
Yeah, it's you've actually seen some of the larger cities really be at the forefront of the smart cities agenda. You've seen a city like New York focusing on their infrastructure that they're providing within their footpaths, within their sidewalks. You've seen a city like they've been putting this infrastructure within their sidewalks called Link NYC, which is an opportunity to create high-speed Wi-Fi hotspots at 200 feet centres all through downtown Manhattan. This then creates an opportunity for people to charge their phones at these facilities because everybody's phones are going flat because we're using them too much to activate smart city technology.
Yeah.
But interestingly, from an urban design point of view, you've actually seen these Wi-Fi hotspots as these portals to a smart city and the world. You've actually seen people create their own pop-up businesses around them. So there's many photographs and even people that I've seen in New York that actually have a small table and their laptop and a chair and their office sign, and they are open for business on the footpath adjacent to these Link NYC podiums. So it's actually quite challenging in terms of the overall planning interface and the regulations associated with that. Another city that you've actually seen is some of the old, I suppose you'd call them the old Rust Belt cities within North America, particularly Pittsburgh. They've really focused hard on transitioning their economy and focused hard on transitioning from a traditional manufacturing steel industry economy into more of a non-knowledge economy. And you've actually seen that in terms of their preparedness to actually bring in tech companies and to actually almost use their city as the test case, to actually use their city as the backdrop for driverless car technology, to actually allow cities, to allow companies, I mean like Uber and Google, to use their city as their classroom to really understand how this cutting edge technology can be used. And you're starting to see some very interesting urban design examples come out of that with the use of that particular technology.
Okay, so I mean, what does that mean when you look at the examples like a Pittsburgh, Austin, and others? Is that an effective way for a city to transition? Is it sustainable?
Look, it's probably too early to say absolutely yes, but all the evidence shows is using that particular catalyst is certainly moving a city forward, such as Pittsburgh, such as Austin, even Atlanta as well, moving those cities forward as now leading edge in their understanding of the smart cities agenda, being at the table in terms of the conversation of what does the urban design and the policy framework sit around smart cities. Whereas traditionally, particularly in a North American context, traditionally that was always predominantly San Francisco and the San Francisco Bay Area, Seattle, but it's now starting to move to those other cities.
This is going to be a very simplistic question, but You know, if I was in government and in charge of changing the agenda for my city and becoming a smart city, what would you say would be the four fundamentals that should be priority? And four is a number I pulled out of my backside. It could be three, it could be five, it could be 10.
Yeah. I'd actually say the biggest thing would be to engage at the three scales. So to engage at a local scale, we've got a lot of smart people in Adelaide. We've got a lot of smart people in Australia. Hardest thing is to keep them. Mm-hmm. So engaging locally and finding a way to keep those ideas. The second thing becomes the commercialization of those ideas. Mm-hmm. That's something that the colleges and the universities in the United States do really well, is actually allowing as an incubator to smart ideas to be tested and proven up to concept within the safe confines of an academic setting or a quasi-academic setting. It's something that we are certainly trying to move to here within Australia and Adelaide, but we have such a depth of talent at our universities within Adelaide, within South Australia. We should really be trying to leverage that talent and to partner with our universities as much as possible to break down those habitual silos between the university and the private sector. That would be the first thing, and maybe the second thing as well. I'm not sure how many points I put forward there. but the other thing is then to focus at that national scale. What's going to elevate Adelaide from a policy and a governance setting at that national scale, and really start to focus on technology and focus on the way that we can start to focus on cities 2.0 and moving to cities 3 within an Adelaide context at that national scale. And the third scale has to be international. It goes back to the points that I was making before about Adelaide competing against 256 other cities, not competing against Melbourne or Sydney. Well, this really becomes that challenge. Mm-hmm. How can Adelaide break out of the pack? Adelaide's got such a great asset in terms of its city centre. It's got a great asset in terms of its education centre and its lifestyle and its cost for business, but how can all that be pulled together within a policy framework and within a governance to actually be used as our competitive advantage?
What other trends are you seeing in global cities, for better or worse?
Yeah, we're actually seeing there's a fairly major trend at the moment. Say it's a trend that's been happening for quite some time, but we're really seeing that, particularly from a North American context, where I've just come back from, very much rediscovering again the city centre, and they call it over there the downtown. But traditionally, through planning policies of the 70s and 80s, you saw a lot of large corporate businesses leave the downtown, leave the city centre of North American cities. We saw it here in Australian cities as well, go out to corporate parks and office parks. Those companies are coming back. We're coming back to the city centre because their employees want to be close to the amenity that the city centre wants. That's now happening in terms of residential population. And a classic example is the city of Melbourne that I think in 1990 approximately had around 8,000 to 10,000 people living in its city centre. Mm. Now has over 100,000.
Yeah,
so you've actually seen that trend happening, and many North American cities, some have been quick adopters than others, are starting to move towards that. It's something that European cities have always always had in terms of their proximity and their association with transit. You're actually seeing ease of transit becoming vitally important. So access to transit, access to public transportation, a good quality public transportation, which is reliable and cheap. That's certainly a trend that has been seen.
Yeah, so that's moving away from driving, commuting?
It's the overall costs of driving, the overall infrastructure costs associated with government. And you're also just seeing the younger generation just not having a desire to drive. Cities such as Portland and Seattle in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, younger people move to those cities just because they're cool cities. And then once they get to those cities, they go, right, now we need to find a job. Now we need a place to live. But they're actually moving to those cities because of the lifestyle. I often think of that as a trend, as a way that, you know, Adelaide has that hidden opportunity. You know, we have a great lifestyle and it could be enhanced. And there's an opportunity for us to be that cool compact city that like Colonel Light always intended us to be all those years ago, and to be a Seattle or a Portland or a Vancouver, where people just, where younger people move to it because it's just a cool city.
I guess one of the concerning trends is housing affordability. Obviously an issue in the States, but we're seeing it here as well. I mean, Perth, Sydney, even Melbourne seems to be going through the roof. Adelaide, bit of a question mark maybe about affordability here. How do you see that?
Oh, look, I'd say housing affordability is an absolutely massive issue, and you've only just seen from a federal political level comments to say that this could be the first generation of Australians that don't have the right to actually purchase their property or won't be given the opportunity to purchase their property, which is certainly changing the mindset of the traditional mindset of Australians and property and owning your own home. One of the biggest challenges with housing affordability, particularly within a Adelaide context, is very much around housing stock. What type of housing stock do we have? We actually see a lot of fringe development happening at the moment in terms of taking a single house or a single block and turning that into two. What that is doing is that's addressing housing affordability in some respects, but what that's doing is not really capturing the full value out of that parcel of land. You're really locking that, it's a very quick win from a development point of view, and you're really locking that parcel of land up for the next 30 or so years without actually getting greater densities and greater opportunities for different types of housing stock. Adelaide predominantly has a very detached housing stock. 77% I should say, of our housing stock is detached, which is above the national average. That then becomes automatically an expensive housing stock. So then if we're trying to address housing affordability, it often then comes through apartment stock or other types of innovative housing typologies, which one could argue that the Adelaide market perhaps isn't educated for yet and is not ready for yet. So then that struggles to then gain a economic return and then also gain a outcome from an affordable aspect.
What are the, I guess, specific urban design implications when housing affordability gets to a crisis point?
It actually, look, you've actually seen some of those challenges happen within the United States. That San Francisco has proven to be going through a massive price affordability problem at the moment, and what's actually happening is that families are unable to live within the city center. They're unable to live where their children go to school. They're unable to live where their parents work, and they're simply just being pushed further and further out of the city. That has a massive cost has a massive social cost in terms of someone's life, how they transport from where they live to where they work. It also has a massive cost on the community where they do live, because what that actually means is they don't really live in their community because they're in transition so much. between where they live to where they work and where they drop their kids off for school, they'd hardly spend any time within their community. They don't engage with local traditional community aspects, whether it's the sporting clubs or whatever. So you actually see a massive disconnect within communities, and that has very large urban implications.
Mm. So that's something we should be wary of in Australia. I'll allow you to have a quick sip of water. But that is that an issue that you see? Has it already come to Australia?
Yeah, it is. And
where, I mean, where is it showing?
Well, it's really starting to pick up within Sydney,
yeah.
And it's starting to pick up in some of the parts of Melbourne, and even some of the areas within the southern part of Queensland, around Brisbane and the Gold Coast. But particularly Sydney's probably the greatest example. We actually see people travel for 2 hours between where they live and where they work, and that's because there isn't, it goes back to what I was saying before about affordable housing, the housing stock, the housing types are not available within a close proximity area to where these people work. So that's where planning comes into play to actually integrate and blend as much as possible employment land and community and residential land as much as possible.
Mm. I mean, this is obviously the massive question that government and everyone's looking at, but in your view, what are some of the key measures that might be able to be taken to perhaps arrest some of this housing affordability issues?
Yeah, actually allowing different housing typologies to be delivered. So that then really starts to focus on planning policy. We often use planning policy as a lever to actually say, right, well, we can take height restrictions away. You can go as tall as you like. Surely the private sector will respond to that. What that does is that this really, the private sector just responds to the market that's prepared to, or the market that has an appetite for developments of that type and size are often 1 and 2 bedrooms. That just adds to the overall problem. You know, you really need to start delivering a greater diversity in housing stock. Actually focusing not on just 1s and 2s, they're important for sure, but focusing on 3s, 4s, 5s bedroom outcomes, like family homes that are close to amenity and close within the city and close to where people work. So actually allowing those planning policies to change the amount of car parking provisions, to change the amount of open space provisions. And look, where credit is due, you have seen particularly the South Australian state government start to move to some of those provisions to actually free up some of that development regulation in terms of allowing that. But the most critical thing is actually allowing a greater housing diversity. You know, I actually did some work over in San Francisco in the south of Market area. There's a very large piece of transport infrastructure happening around there. It's a $2 billion project, being the Transbay Terminal project, which actually links Los Angeles and San Francisco through the California High Speed Rail. And there's a whole series of development parcels with around this particular precinct. And what had been delivered is they were pretty much 1 and 2 bedroom housing stock. 70% of the housing stock that had been delivered was 1 and 2 bedroom. And that was really adding to the problem of pushing families out of what was traditionally a family orientated part of the city of San Francisco. So the work that we actually did within San Francisco was then to focus on, say, well, let's show how we can deliver housing stock that is available for families. And we actually did that by creating a whole series of design rules, planning policy rules, which then linked into an urban framework that showed that you can still deliver the huge targets in terms of population, and their target was 8,000 to 10,000, but you can do it in a way that it not only just focuses on the short-term outcome of 1s and 2s and singles and people working elsewhere but residing within this part, but to actually link it to the amenity of the Transbay Terminal, link it to the schools, link it to grocery shops, link it to the proximity to open space, and to have three-bedroom units within there. And one of the biggest ways that we did that was by manipulating the open space rules. So actually allowing for shared open space. So instead of actually, as we currently have within most Australian planning development plans, if you build an apartment, you need to provide X square metres of open space, private open space. So let's say argue that that's 50 square metres of open space per bedroom in each apartment. What we were able to propose in San Francisco was say, well, instead of delivering that, why don't we actually deliver 150 square metres of shared high-quality public open space or private open space, a shared private open spaces instead of just being a courtyard, which is 50 square metres. Yeah. And what that's done is, and you've seen that that's been picked up by San Francisco in their planning policy, is what that's done is that's actually created a whole series of high quality private open spaces, and it's also starting to link communities together. It's actually creating that opportunity for people to get out of their apartments and to actually reconnect with their communities around high quality open space. So that then also has that social importance within that as well.
Yeah. So on that, I guess to take that a step further is in your role and when you're given the responsibility of overseeing the development of a community, a new area, what are the core principles, rules, as you mentioned, that you're looking at in terms of things like mixed use and these open spaces?
Yeah. No. Look, it's very important again to focus on what are the issues that we're trying to solve and really understand what is the aspiration of the community. I think it's very important, and this is some of the work that City Collective is currently involved in. We're actually doing quite a lot of work in the urban repair area. And what that is it really focuses on bringing a policy, the private sector, the developers, the landowners, and the community together to actually deliver an outcome that the community expects, it wants, but then also has compromise in terms of what the developer needs to achieve and also what's allowed under the planning framework. So this whole notion of delivering communities through urban repair, stitching together streets, stitching together that disused site that the community has always felt it was an eyesore or was unsafe, actually turning that inside out and actually allowing equitable access. That becomes really important from a community point of view, is actually allowing that equitable access to open space, to the amenity that a community may want, but then also allowing a community to transition through their own lives within that community. And that comes back to housing typologies and housing stock again.
From a business perspective, how has City Collective evolved? You mentioned you're doing work in Adelaide, San Francisco. How are you, I guess, building a global business from where you are?
Well, it's pretty exhausting. but no, look, we're actually pretty unique in the way that we offer our design services. It's very much, as I've been mentioning, it's very much focused around what are the issues and the challenges that cities, private sector, the government sector, institutions have, and how can an integrated approach of urban design, architecture, and planning deliver those particular solutions. And as we spoke about earlier, you need to think at a very large picture, and you need to think at very long-term scale. We're doing projects at the moment in Adelaide, in Melbourne, in Sydney, doing work up in the Gold Coast, and starting to pick up opportunities over in the United States as well, and continuing our involvement in some of the work that we've already been involved with over there in San Francisco. So, it's very challenging. One of the biggest opportunities is actually just to re-educate the market within the, an Australian context of what is urban design.
Mm.
Urban design is very much that that integrated approach of it's the discipline, in my way of thinking, that that sits in the centre between architecture and planning, landscape architecture and economic analysis, and it uses a piece of all of those aspects to deliver appropriate design-led thinking outcomes. And that's very much the a approach that City Collective focuses on. We focus on primarily projects that relate to how people live, how communities operate and function. So we do some open space and street planning, street design. We also focus on transit how people navigate around their city, and we also focus on sports. So we're doing a whole series of sporting projects at the moment, from community sporting infrastructure all the way up to professional sports infrastructure.
Mm. I'd imagine it's very much a credibility-based business where you do a good job with some projects, word gets out. Is that, I guess, the primary way of winning the work, based on reputation?
Yeah. It is. And we've been incredibly fortunate with the clients that we've been able to secure. They've been really loyal. They've also had very large mouths and told other people.
That's good.
Which has been excellent. Those other people have travelled, and my phone number still works, and our phone number still works no matter where they are. So, no, it's been a very fortunate. It's been very exciting, and it's a bit of a challenge to actually offer something that the market doesn't really have, and nobody's ever tried before. But it seems to be working so far. Yeah.
As we wind up, I'm conscious of your time, David. We're always fascinated about how, I guess, the early beginnings. So where did this passion for urban design first begin? Was it something that you were born with, or was it a bit of a late blooming type of thing?
Yeah, well, I'd actually say it's probably a bit of a late bloomer.
Yep.
I started out as an architect and worked in the commercial architecture sector for a number of years. Worked down that particular path, and suppose up the corporate chain, but it was really something that was sitting in the back of my mind, and I started to get exposed to a whole series of larger scale thinking. I was, like almost every architect, I was involved in the Adelaide Oval project, and it was at that scale of working in that design teams, starting to think of those larger connections, those larger opportunities. And I started to focus on that. I was then incredibly fortunate a few years ago to be given an opportunity as the first South Australian to be given a scholarship to go to University of California in Berkeley. It's not often you actually get a chance to put Adelaide on the map, but there's a giant map within the college, and I actually was able to put a star where Adelaide was.
Right, there you go.
So it may actually be the very last literally. Time I ever get to put Adelaide on the map. But it was a great opportunity, and then really coming back from that, my eyes had been and my mind had been opened up to the opportunities of urban design, the challenges that all cities face, and the challenges that Adelaide faces and Australian cities face, but also the confidence to know that we're not alone in facing those challenges, and that if we actually use a collaborative approach and collaborative thinking internationally, then we can start to solve and really get some good outcomes from an urban design point of view within the Adelaide sector. I must admit, I still have to talk to quite a lot of potential clients who challenge me and say, "Well, what is urban design? What is architecture? Isn't it just the same thing? Are you still going to be? Is your office still going to be drawing elevations of buildings and roof plans and toilet plans?" To which, of course, we say yes. but yeah, it is a challenge, but it's also a very exciting one, and it's really great to actually head overseas to learn and experience, and then be given an opportunity to bring that back to your home state and your home city and try and change.
Now, I don't have James here to troll me about my poor rapid fire skills, but this is where we generally we attempt to have these rapid fire questions, which end up with me asking long-winded questions, which I'm doing right now. Is there a piece of architecture or a building or a site that inspires or motivates you that's not your own?
I would say this, the entire city of San Francisco.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there anything specific within San Francisco?
It's really just how that city has evolved, how its street grid allows for urbanization, how it connects to the water, how it actually is proudly and identifiably San Francisco. Mm. And it's actually used its history, but it's adopted its history. Every city has a parent, and San Francisco's parents are parts of New York, Brooklyn. Those parents of Brooklyn come from the United Kingdom, and so it goes on. But San Francisco really linked into the materials that were available at its time. One of the even though this is meant to be a quick question, am I meant to provide a quick answer?
No, absolutely. It's completely up to you.
One of the real interesting things about that city that inspires me is most of the building stock there is just over 100 years old, because it had a massive earthquake in 1906, where 95% of the city was completely destroyed. So much of the building stock there is from 1906 onwards. So it's actually a credit to that city and to focus on just being San Francisco and having that confidence. And I often think about that for Adelaide, let's just be Adelaide. Let's just have that confidence to be Adelaide. We don't have to be anybody else. Let's just be Adelaide.
Awesome. Least favourite city?
Oh, no, I can't.
You've probably got to be careful.
No, I can't answer that. every city has its own unique qualities. How's that for a very diplomatic answer?
That's very diplomatic. I could have put you in a corner there. Sorry about that.
I often notice when I go to cities, and I love traveling and seeing different things. You can always learn from something. Mm. When I start drinking at lunch, that's often a sign that the city may not have much to offer.
And really? I thought it could be a good thing.
I like to take lots of photos and walk streets and stuff like that and do some sketches and whatever. But when I find I've propped myself up at a bar at around lunch or 2 o'clock or whatever, I'm going, okay, might settle in here.
Well, maybe it's a slight giveaway. If someone crosses paths with you overseas one time and they see you drinking at midday, it's like, oh, he doesn't like this city.
Maybe.
A couple of your favourite projects that you've worked on. This is my final question.
Yeah. They're probably projects that we're working on now. Mm-hmm. Really enjoying working with some of the AFL clubs that we're doing work with, helping them deliver their strategic plans within a urban and architectural context. We're doing a project at the moment in Theberdom. Mm-hmm. So really doing a piece of I would almost argue that it's Adelaide's first piece of urban repair. Really bringing the community that's there, which isn't much, but bringing the community that's there, not trying to do any gentrification or push them out, actually using that as let's actually leverage off of that, not trying to demolish the buildings, let's repurpose the buildings. So
Lebanon's fantastic.
Yeah. So
it was Adelaide's first suburb, is that right?
I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, I think that's just me reading somewhere. Yeah,
maybe Marland or...
Yeah, it was definitely one of the first, I think. Yeah. But, you know, those beautiful old homes. I was glad to hear that you said you're not planning to get rid of any of them.
No. So the site that we're working on has that opportunity of being close to Port Road, and it's a 4-hectare site. It's has the opportunity of being close to the Torrens. So to really create those connections, you know, in the same way that I love San Francisco, that it has that grid that's unrelenting over the topography. You know, opportunities to actually do similar types of things within this part of Earth Hebbenan. The Adelaide Oval certainly was a project that I thoroughly enjoyed. It was actually my first ever job as a 13-year-old kid, was actually stamping the members' tickets at the Adelaide Oval, which I was very excited about let the Australian and the West Indian cricket team in, and Alan Border and Kirtley Ambrose and Sir Donald Bradman would come in through my turnstile, and I'd press the lever, and I'd always, there was only one rule working at the Oval as a kid. You weren't allowed to stamp Sir Donald's ticket. Every year he had to have a unmarked member's ticket. So if you were fortunate enough for himself and Lady Bradman to come to your turnstile, you'd just press the lever and give the ticket back and say, good morning, Sir Donald. Good morning, Lady Bradman. And he would shuffle on inside the oval. Wow. But no, that was often say that my career's gone downhill ever since then. I actually peaked too early to work at the Oval like that. But it was nice from a professional point of view to then be involved in the design team that delivered the new Adelaide Oval.
Awesome. Well, David, thanks so much for sharing your awesome insights. We've been super keen to talk about urban design on Rooster Radio, and this is the first, I think we're up to episode 80, and I'm ashamed to say that it's taken us so long to get to it.
Well, that's okay. You finally got there.
Yeah, thanks very much for your time, mate. You know, the stuff about Olympics and games is current and sustainable cities. In fact, I did a subject of sustainable cities at university. Regular listeners will know that I've only got a semi-complete degree, and I somehow ended up doing a sustainable cities subject, but it was fascinating.
Yeah, very good.
So it was great to continue that discussion.
Yeah, excellent. Well, look, thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Rooster Radio. Now, before you go, can I ask a quick favour? Go to roosterradio.biz and sign up to our mailing list. We have some news and events coming up that we want you to be a part of. Secondly, if you like what we're doing, please leave us a review on iTunes. Much appreciated. And finally, you can join us on Facebook at facebook.com/roosterradiohq.